Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In 30 minutes, we go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with stories that really matter. And coming up on the program, Transnet's chair on a multi-billion rand Durban port investment, and will the beleaguered parastatal need more government money? Has South Africa finally reached tax collection tipping point? The rooibos industry has no choice but to ramp up its sustainability approach, and new questions over South Africa's commitment to fighting corruption. It's Friday, the 28th of February. South Africa's ports have long struggled with inefficiency, but a major investment is now set to change that. Transnet has committed 3.4 billion rand to upgrading its fleet, with the Durban Container Terminal receiving the largest share. Now, if I've read this correctly, the funding is going to bring over 100 new cargo handling machines, improving operational capacity and potentially easing the backlog that has plagued the port for some time. As part of its broader recovery plan, Transnet is also aiming to enhance infrastructure, improve efficiency, and create a more reliable supply chain for businesses who are wholly dependent on port logistics. Joining me now to discuss this investment and what it means broadly for Transnet and Africa's trade and the economy is Andile Sangqu, who is chairperson of Transnet. Chairperson, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. First of all, what has prompted the utility to allocate such a significant portion of its investment to Durban?
Thanks very much, Jeremy. You would recall that in 2023, December, we had a significant congestion, in our ports that really put a lot of strain, on our ability to transport goods in and out of the country. And there's a board that came into office in July 2023. We had then approved a recovery plan in October 2023. And one of the key issues that was part of that plan was that of upgrading of our port equipment and also improving safety in our ports, making our ports reliable, safe, efficient, and also having equipment that was dependable and also embracing the latest technology. So this program actually started last year, if you recall. We received delivery of 7 tugboats to a cost of about 1 billion rand, and 5 of those were in the port of Durban, and then the others were in the port of Port Elizabeth and also in East London. So this investment is an acceleration of that program of upgrading of our ports, and also addressing the kind of issues that were systemic that created the situation that we found ourselves in December 2023. So all of these, this is part of the first batch of these equipment, which will be delivered for the rest of the year. There's a scheduled delivery program that has been set up. We're starting with Durban as of yesterday, and in March, April, we will be receiving equipment of the same magnitude in terms of quality and reliability to the port of Cape Town, and we'll be rolling out to our other ports. So indeed, to answer your question, there is a lot of intentionality and deliberateness to implement our recovery plan and to make sure that we actually change you know, the complexion of how our port system operates.
I acknowledge the intentionality, but the argument would be that you've left this all far too late, particularly in Durban, which has found itself in a parlous position over the past couple of years. What's the timeline then, Chairperson, for when all the new machinery is going to be fully operational and make a real difference?
So, Jeremy, your first point is correct. Indeed, this could have been done long time ago, but I certainly wouldn't want to delve so much in the past. I mean, the past is what it is. We have all learned from it. And it certainly has, I must thank our employees that despite all of those challenges, they remain very steadfast in terms of making the best and making sure that we are able to operate despite those challenging conditions. So we're very grateful for them to be able to do that. Equally, we believe that with the new equipment that is now coming on board, it will create, you know, good motivation on the side of the employees. It will make our customers happy. Certainly, it will have a positive boost in terms of the economic activities, both inside the port, but generally in terms of the economy as a whole. To answer your question, our plan is that, as I indicated, we started with this delivery. Some of those equipment have already been commissioned, and we're working steadily. Our plan is to have the last batch delivered in December of this year. So as we receive them, we commission them, we bring them into the system. So I think maybe I can safely say a year from now, despite the fact that the last batch will be delivered in December, this time next year, we should be fully on full throttle in terms of all of these pieces of equipment, which we believe in our view that it's a massive game changer for our overall ports in South Africa.
Having said that, and that's good news on the long-term horizon, short-term, though, Transnet's problems still continue, don't they? We now hear talk of another 50 billion rand bailout, and if that is going to go ahead, it would be the largest financial risk that the government is going to face in 2025. Are you turning things around with the speed with which they are needed?
Look, I think it's fair to say that, when you're dealing with this kind of a complex problem that we have, a Transnet, which is multi-layered and multi-dimensional, you have to focus on key things, you know, and fix them well and make sure that they are fully operational and are running. So the fact that we are focusing on our ports to make sure that we invest, we make the right kind of investment in equipment. Equipment alone, of course, does not turn things around. You also need to make sure that we create the right culture. You know, we improve productivity, we train our people, and make sure that there are good incentives to keep them going. We want to believe that if we get that working, it certainly is creating new momentum. And there's nothing that breeds success more than success itself. So our focus, we're quite deliberate to say, look, let's fix this. And then, of course, there's some other improvements that are being made in the rest of the operations in the business. So you're quite right in terms of dealing with the larger programs and problems within Transnet. But I do think that what matters is to make sure that there's a very disciplined focus and execution in those small parts of our business and get them up and running.
And finally, if I could ask you this, with investors then and stakeholders watching you very closely, are you able to give us a categorical assurance that the turnaround plan that you've spoken about remains credible and is not going to require further bailouts in the near future?
Well, I mean, that wouldn't be fair to say. I mean, because we've always said right from the start that for this recovery plan to be fully executed, you know, it's going to require capital. And we've been very open and transparent about that. However, how that capital is sourced, it would require a combination of equity capital and also leveraging some of the capital from the private sector. And we are currently working on a construct, you know, that would make sure that we get the right balance. So I cannot categorically say to you that it is possible to have a full execution of the recovery plan without any additional financial support.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Andile Sangu, who is chairperson of Transnet. I do appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The great budget VAT increase hike proposal continues to cause much consternation, and now in a new opinion piece, respected financial commentator Kai Sitoli is arguing that South Africa's fiscal challenges cannot be resolved through taxation alone. He goes on to say the necessity for robust economic growth to bridge the widening fiscal gap is critical. He also contends that relying on tax hikes is a short-term solution that fails to address the underlying issues that continue to stifle our economy. He joins me now. Kaya, you assert that tax increases then are insufficient to address South Africa's fiscal challenges. That VAT hike that was proposed seemed to be an instant solution, but it really backfired, didn't it?
Yeah, it backfired, and it should have backfired, because what is very important for all of us to reflect on is the fact that whether you're talking about VAT, whether you're talking about corporate income tax or even personal income tax, all of those taxes are actually a byproduct of a particular activity. So personal income taxes are primarily a byproduct of employment. And if people are unemployed, as they are in South Africa, you face a challenge there. Corporate income taxes are a byproduct of businesses thriving, businesses being profitable. And in the South African case, we do not have a very strong base of profitable companies. Similarly, when it comes to VAT, it is again a result of underlying economic activity, transactional level that then generates the tax. So whichever way you look at it, it all comes down to the single question of what is the baseline foundation that enables either of these taxes to actually grow. And that answer is always going to be economic activity. And in South Africa's case, we simply haven't grown the economy, so it is inevitable that even these taxes, at whatever rate you pitch them, will eventually exhaust their capacity to make a meaningful contribution to the fiscus. And when it comes to VAT, the Commission has been very clear that whether you say 2% or 3%, I don't think it's going to get us very far, because, again, the underlying base, which is economic activity, robust economic activity, quite simply isn't there.
If we'd seen that 2 percentage point hike, would we have reached a tipping point where that capacity that you refer to would have been exhausted?
The Commissioner says we already reached that tipping point, and his reference point is that 7 years ago, we saw the hike from 14% to 15%, and he says that he simply hasn't seen the windfalls of that. Now, what is interesting about this proposed hike from 15 to 17% is that it wasn't simply a matter of a hike. It was a matter of a hike that then came with this concept of vertical equity. And what that seeks to do is to say that, look, if you're going to implement a blanket tax of this nature, you're going to have to identify those that are going to suffer the most from it and find a way to insulate them. So what the minister also proposed at the same time was to expand the basket of goods that are then regarded as critical enough to be used by the vast majority of citizens who really spend every single cent that they have on what they need. So expanding that basket of goods would have then protected them from the effect of this. He also simultaneously proposed an increase in the cash advances that they receive in the form of social grants. So that is how he then balanced this question of, well, blanket taxes are notoriously bad and because they affect the poor. So he then said, well, I'm going to specifically target some relief towards the poor. So that's how this was planned, this was pitched. But the reality here is that in light of the punitive taxes that everybody else is complaining about in all other forms, whether it's direct or indirect taxes, we do not know whether this 2% would have generated the net amount that was proposed, which is around 58 billion rand for this year and going up to 60 and 64 billion for the next 2 years. We do not know, because it's always down to the question of, well, once the tax has been implemented, how many people actually still transact in order to generate the tax, and also how good our collection systems are. And when you have a SARS commissioner that says that our collection systems could be better, you kind of see what the problem is with this hike.
You use the word balance. How then can this country balance the immediate and urgent need for revenue, because there's a huge gap, with the long-term goal of real and sustainable and meaningful economic growth?
I think at this stage, pragmatism must prevail. And the pragmatist in me says that, look, if the commissioner is to be taken at his own word, he has given us a remarkably huge number. He says there's 800 billion rand that he leaves on the table every single year because he doesn't have the best capacitated or the most ideal collection systems. So he's arguing that with better resources, they can collect more. under the existing tax dimension and therefore solve this problem. Now, even if he's 50% right, even if he's 40% right, right, even if he's only 10% right, an additional 80 billion rand would be the type of tax that immediately solves the problem, the gap that we're trying to find here. So the only question that I think we should be deliberating on now is how much does the commissioner need in order for him to be able to extract what he says is sitting idle that he cannot get rid of? And even if he's 90% wrong, I still think we're better off.
So it's also back then to your original point about economic growth strategies. What specific approaches are you proposing which would be more effective then? And again, there is a degree of short-termism here, which is critical.
Well, the most important thing is that at this stage, there actually isn't an economic blueprint. South Africa has absolutely no standing blueprint that says that this is where we think the country's economy should go, this is where we think it is, and these are the instruments that are going to get us there. So it's not really a matter of a different approach, it's a matter of an approach. And I think the problem that we have, unfortunately, is that the quest towards economic growth is an intersectional one. You need a properly capacitated education system, which you do not have. You need a properly capacitated skills baseline, which you do not have. And you need a properly capacitated re-education and reskilling pipeline, which means that those that entered the job market 30 years ago when teaching algebra, you required particular resources. If those people are going to be in the workforce and now need to teach new skills and new technologies, do they have the capacity to reskill? So we actually don't have those foundational building blocks that are going to enable us to get onto the pathway of building a better economy. And then at the higher level, you then have the question of, well, even within the existing economic architecture, we have far too many bottlenecks. We have far too many overlaps in the system that make it difficult for even those that have means or even have ideas to be able to innovate their way up to creating tangible and substantive businesses. So again, the blueprint simply doesn't exist.
So it's a very honest but gloomy assessment. Are you saying that it's a case of abandon all hope now?
I think it is a case of finally having to take the difficult decisions that for many years we've simply deferred because we could borrow our way through it. So if you look at the pathway of borrowings that we were engaged in the past 15 years, you can clearly see that it was a patchwork solution towards this particular crisis point. It was a patchwork solution that did not tackle the underlying question of, wait, why are we borrowing in the first place? And the simple answer is that, well, governments are run through two resources, either taxes or borrowing, and taxes require underlying economic activity. So because we didn't have a government that knew how to build a blueprint towards that economic momentum, they simply then went for the next best option, which was borrowing. But borrowings are indeed exhausted, and borrowings are actually the worst evil, because what they do is that they tend to steal from what little you have. So at this stage, even tomorrow, National Treasury will be settling 46 billion rand in interest just tomorrow. And that is on the back of a 390 billion rand interest bill that they have just for this year alone. Now, if you consider what you could have done with that amount of money, that 390 billion rand is crowding out all the other priorities that the government has. So borrowing is never a good idea. It hasn't been a good idea for the past 15 years, and now we're paying the price for it. So we need people who are going to figure out how to deal with that.
Just a final one. How do you respond to critics who might argue that in the absence of immediate tax increases, such as value-added tax, essential public services are going to suffer due to dramatic funding shortfalls?
They already have been suffering. So whether you are looking at the shortfall in the health frontline workers, some people actually have skills but cannot get employed, which is just very strange in a country like ours. If you look at the capacity issues that we have in the basic education system, everywhere you look, if you ask the Minister of Home Affairs, who is from the DA, he will tell you that, well, actually, all these years I've been saying from the sidelines that we need to cut. I now realize that we actually need more resources. So we already have a defunding crisis at the front line. What happened is that when National Treasury could not convince the political principals of the ANC, as it was then, exclusively in government, cut down or rein in their spending, they engaged in an undeclared austerity program, which meant that they would send directives to departments to say that, look, don't hire more, freeze the posts that you have, and sometimes even incentivize senior civil servants to exit the civil service. That has unintended consequences, because whenever you give an incentive for people to exit early, you only actually are talking to the people that believe they can be able to launch a second career outside the civil service. In other words, it's more likely you're more competent bureaucrats. A person who feels that, look, I probably haven't learned anything else to be able to thrive in the private sector, that person is not going to leave the comforts of a job in government. So you end up decapacitating the state with this particular perverse incentives. Again, it's all patchwork. And the reality here is that until you tackle the foundational issues of how to build an economy suitable for the type of issues that you've decided to prioritize as a political party or even a political alliance, this is what happens.
Kaya Sitoli, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's corruption challenges are well documented, and many hope the proposed Anti-Corruption Commission would bring meaningful change. However, the 21st Amendment Bill, which aimed to create an independent body to investigate high-level corruption, has been rejected. So what does this mean for the ongoing fight against corruption? I want to give you a view today now from Edward James, partner at the law firm Pinsent Masons. Edward, a very warm welcome to you. The National Prosecuting Authority arguing that the bill was premature and something called a multi-agency model would be preferable. What's your understanding of that, and what do you think that might mean in practice?
My understanding of the National Prosecuting Authority's opposition to the bill is that they believe that the current structures in place, which is a multi-agency approach between existing law enforcement currently in place, is better than concentrating efforts in a single new agency. So in essence, they're saying more of the same, but fix what's already there. That's their view as to what the solution is. I respectfully hold a different view.
Well, let's talk about that different view, because I think there would be general concordance that more of the same hasn't really worked in recent years.
I tend to agree. And, you know, if I look back in history, we had a single so-called super agency to combat corruption and other complex crime. And that was, of course, the Scorpions. Now, I myself, when I was a university graduate, in fact, wanted to join the Scorpions. And as I completed my degree, they were disbanded. Now, yeah, I can quote Chief Justice Zondo, and he described that decision to effectively disband the Scorpion as the worst decision ever in the combating of corruption in South Africa. And I tend to agree with him.
So there is the argument, of course, that even if we'd seen the establishment of this anti-corruption commission, it might have strengthened South Africa's response to the in the fight. There might have been the danger of creating unnecessary duplication and people walking over each other's patches.
Well, I don't think that's a particularly strong argument, because there currently is, to a degree, duplicated functions between different agencies and the like. And what the bill does is it set out a pretty clear roadmap to carve out the most serious corruption cases and to put that within the remit of the anti-corruption agency. And this is done overseas. We can cite a jurisdiction like the United Kingdom. They have the Serious Fraud Office, which deals with the most serious cases. And then they have other agencies that deals with things that don't fall within that remit. It's not that difficult to work out, and it's not that difficult to implement.
Do you think there's a risk now that rejecting this bill signals a lack of political will in this country to address corruption at the highest levels? We've simply put our hands up in the air.
Well, I think maybe to reposition that, that the bill hasn't technically been rejected by Parliament. It's been opposed by key stakeholders, including the NPA, as well as the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. So they've gone before the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development on the 12th of February this year, and they've said they are not supportive. Now, this is a member's bill, and just to explain that very quickly, that means that a member of Parliament, Linus Breitenbach, put the bill forward. It wasn't put forward by the presidency or by the full GNU or anything of the sort. So it may be that a bill in a revised form is approved at some point, but these key institutions are saying they don't agree with it. And that is a problem.
Well, the question still remains is that there does seem to be at the very highest level a lack of will to actually do this and move forward with in addressing what is remains a very serious problem.
Yeah, well, I'd agree that there seems to be a lack of pace. And I'd like to defer to one of the reasons given by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development for not being supportive. And they've said that there is already a National Anti-Corruption Advisory Council with an established process to make recommendations on this point to the president. What I question, of course, is why has it taken 2.5 years and there's still no recommendations? So this may be that the wheels are just turning slowly as opposed to there being the actual political will, but there certainly is a problem with pace. People want to see results, they want to see change, and we do need change now.
So leading on from that then, given that things are moving slowly, what do you think the next steps would be or should be for this country to strengthen and also accelerate its legal and institutional frameworks in the fight against corruption? A very long-winded way of saying what should be next.
Well, with the utmost respect to the National Anti-Corruption Advisory Council, I think they need to speed up the pace of their work. I think they need to finish and make clear recommendations and stop delaying. And I think government needs to listen to that and action it. I am hoping that they see the sense in a single agency. Chief Justice Raymond Zondo recommended exactly the same thing in his report a very long time ago. So I'm hoping that there's speed, pace, and that the GNU is able to get this across the line.
It is a very serious issue. Edward James, thank you very much indeed. Partner at the law firm Pinsent Masons, I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa is losing biodiversity at an alarming rate, with habitat destruction putting indigenous species and ecosystems at risk. But in the Cederberg region, the rooibos industry is proving that farming and conservation can coexist. So I guess the question is, could this be a blueprint for sustainable agriculture? Are there lessons that other sectors can learn? And maybe more importantly, what does this mean for economic and environmental resilience in a country where farming and conservation often at odds? From the Rooibos Council, I'm joined by Martine Swart. A very warm welcome to you. Let's start with this before we talk about the conservation side of the dynamic. Can you give me some context here? How big is the rooibos industry, and maybe particularly as far as exports are concerned?
Annually, the rooibos industry, obviously, it fluctuates because rooibos, for those who do not know, is a dry land crop. So we are dependent on rainfall for the volumes that the industry produce year on year. But so we produce between about, say, 17 to 20,000 tons a year. And from there, 10,000 more or less, we just under the 10,000 is exported annually. And we've actually seen very nice growth. Say, for example, in the period, if we take back our minds to 2020, we were at 7.5. So we are seeing good growth in export for rooibos.
Now let's talk about the conservation side of the dynamic. What makes this particular crop and the sector uniquely suited for conservation?
So rooibos grows, you of course know that rooibos only grows in South Africa, and it only grows in the Cederberg area. And from there also we were able to do the registration of the geographical indication in the EU a few years ago. But rooibos is cultivated, originally comes from, because it's originally a wild plant, and comes from the Cape Floral Kingdom. And the Cape Floral Kingdom is the smallest floral kingdom in the world and the only one contained within the borders of one country. So it's really a very special piece of fauna and flora. And for this reason, while one does agricultural activity there and runs industries out of the area, it's very important that you have a clear, understanding and care for the environment.
Why is it important for rooibos farmers then to live in some degree of harmony or symbiosis with nature itself, particularly when it comes to restoring endangered habitats. What's the thinking here, Martinet?
I think if you speak to any rooibos farmer, they are the people who would have the best understanding and a very deep understanding of how dependent they are for the survival of their industry on the health of the environment. So what they do is they really look at their farming practices. And I think for many industries, and as we see climate change and as we see various challenges with biodiversity loss, etc., it becomes a real focus for many industries and a continuous, very careful balancing act between industry and the care for the environment.
Is this a race against time as far as the industry is concerned? In other words, if you don't do this, the sector itself could be in danger.
I don't think the sector itself could be in danger. Rooibos is a very hardy plant. It comes from the Cedarburg, and it was cultivated originally from wild stock. We still don't irrigate it, mostly don't irrigate it. There are a few farmers that will irrigate the rooibos, but the plant is from the Cedarburg and adapted to the climatic conditions there. And if we think back to 2018, I think we would all remember we had a significant drought conditions. And even though we then in those years would see a little bit of a reduction in the rooibos volumes, the plant and the industry, etc., would still survive. It's a hardcore plant. So while one must certainly look after the environment and give it the best possible chance, we have never felt from the side of the rooibos industry that because of climate change, the industry is in danger. No.
Are these conservation efforts that farmers make actually financially viable, or is it a trade-off?
I think that's a tricky question. We don't really think about it, I think, in terms of finance. It's more a question of sustainability of the industry. So, for example, if one had to really go from a purely financial point of view and just clear as many hectares and farm as much rooibos as you can, this is bad for the sustainability of the industry. I also think that if you look, for example, after your soil, because rooibos is dry land, we do practice sustainable water. We work well with water, but the soil in the Cedarburg is very important. Rooibos likes a very specific kind of soil, and one has to invest in the soil to make sure that the plants have a little bit of resilience if a drought comes or that they really grow well. And I think in that instance, if you do, to come back to your original question, if you do good environmental practices, it is going to save you. You are going to see increased volume. You are going to see healthier plants, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a balancing act, but I don't think we view care for the environment as a trade-off against finance, no.
What specific practices have been implemented then?
From a farming point of view, I already spoke to care for the soil, and we work responsibly with water as far as this is possible. And then the farmers also keep bands of the original fynbos around their rooibos fields. And these are now all agricultural practices. But we also want to look after the wider environment in the Cedarburg. And there are actually a number of initiatives. I think we all have a kind of a little bit of a romantic idea of, you know, when you go to the Cedarburg and you really want to see a leopard. A few years ago, it would have been harder for you to see a leopard, but the leopard of the Cape, there's now the Cape Leopard Trust, and many rooibos and other farmers in the area, you know, also potato farmers in that area, really, they give parts of their farmland back for conservation and also to make sure that the habitat of these cats are protected. And then, I don't know if many of the listeners would know, but this, if you think about the Cedarburg, so we often say the Cedarburg, but in the Cedarburg, we find a tree called the Clan William cedar. And a while ago, these trees were really abundant, but because of overexploitation and climate change, there was a massive reduction in stock. And we really saw a decline to the point where they became critically endangered. Mm. So there's now an initiative where nurseries are established and farmers are really planting and resettling these trees in their natural environment. Right.
Martinet, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
Marvelous.
From the Rooibos Council. Appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that's MoneyWeb at midday for today. We're back on Monday with another 30 minutes of news and analysis. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.